by WFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide at www.weft.org. The views and opinions are strictly ours. Do not represent any of the opinions necessarily of the station manager or anyone else here at WFT in a position of authority. Okay, so here's Tom with some acknowledgments of some of our underwriters.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalitions amongst workers, unions, and the community, the Illinois Education Association and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice are proud to support WEFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. This hour of programming is also brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you, the listeners of WEFT, and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thanks, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us in this week's edition of the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's brand new poem for this week, first here live on the Illinois World Labor Hour, is entitled Our Locomotive Nation. Also here with us today is co-host Bob Polesny, our technical expert and advisor, who will have some news and banner for us as well. So here we go, off the show.
Local not-for-profit organizations working for peace and justice and systemic change may apply for grants from the Illinois Disciples Foundation this month. The nonprofit foundation gave 19 Champaign County organizations more than $175,000 last year, the first year of the program. Amongst those were the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, the Champaign County Christian Health Center, the Crisis Nursery, and the Greater Community AIDS Project. A complete list of current grant recipients is available at www.ildisciplesfoundation.org/grants. Any organization that wants to request money for sustenance this year needs to first submit a letter of inquiry to the Illinois Disciples Foundation by February 19th. Further information is available at area code 217, the number 352-8721. That's 217-352-8721. Bob?
Okay, I got a story out of Australia from Wednesday, I believe. Australian employers added workers for a fifth straight month in January, and the jobless rate fell. The number of people employed gained 52,700 from December, the Statistics Bureau said in Sydney today. The median of 21 economists surveyed by Bloomberg was for an increase of only 15,000, and the jobless rate fell from 5.3% fell to 5.3% from 5.5%. This is the longest run of hiring gains in almost 2 years and increases pressures on the central bank governor, Glenn Stevens, to resume raising borrowing costs in 2010 after he unexpectedly kept the benchmark interest rate unchanged last week. The number of full-time jobs gained 15,900 in January, and part-time employment increased 36,900, the report showed. Governor Stevens became the first central banker in the world to raise borrowing costs three times last year after Australia's economy skirted the global recession, helped by $20 billion in cash handouts to consumers from Prime Minister Kevin Rudd and another $22 billion in spending on roads, railways, and schools. The central bank says Australia's economic growth will accelerate this year, boosted by demand from China for natural resources sources such as coal and iron ore, that will deepen the scarcity of workers. It now looks like the unemployment rate has peaked at around 5.75%, a much better outcome than thought likely early this year, when the government forecast the jobless rate would reach about 8.5%. A shortage of workers may increase costs and cause delays at the nation's liquefied natural gas projects. Dave?
Okay, annual fees at the University of California in 1979 were $685. 30 years later, they rose to $10,302. The University of California's appointed regents, who oversee 10 campuses throughout the state, voted to raise fees again by 32% to begin next fall. Schools throughout the state's three-tiered public education system, including hundreds of state schools and junior colleges, are also seeing fee hikes and program cuts. In response, an unprecedented coalition of students and workers is fighting the attacks on affordable higher education with large-scale democratic organizing, including marches, teach-ins, strikes, and building occupations. Technical, clerical, and service workers facing layoffs and cuts to the bargaining table have also entered the fray. The coalition of students, university workers, and members of communities occupied several administration buildings for several days back in November. The takeover wasn't easily accomplished. Police videotaped protesters and threatened arrest of those who peacefully remained inside on the first night. Students and workers voted for 3 days of action to coincide with the regents' meeting in late November, where the tuition hike would be decided. Students also called for a three-day strike at Berkeley, coincide with the clerical and technical workers' walkouts. November 20th, students barricaded themselves inside the second floor of Wheeler Hall. They communicated their demands by bullhorn to thousands of supporters gathered outside. UC called in several police departments, which were unable to break the barricades for several hours. A student held the doors and called for negotiations. Throughout the day, students linked arms in tussles with cops, while others sat down the street to block police trucks trying to enter the campus. Police eventually arrested 40, but faculty and students negotiated their release. Service workers with AFSCME Local 3299 also helped out and supported the student organizing and occupation. They blocked several of the entrances to buildings. One of the several actions aimed at reversing layoffs, 44 have lost their jobs at Berkeley. And coming up here in a couple of weeks on March 4th, a new round of demonstrations and building occupations will begin with a wider coalition, this time involving K through 12 public schools, teachers, parents, and students. So we'll keep you posted on that as that develops.
Key politicians announced last week that Caterpillar Incorporated, the world's largest manufacturer of mining and construction equipment, plans to join a coalition of companies planning to build the experimental clean coal power plant known as FutureGen. Governor Pat Quinn and Senator Dick Durbin announced the decision of Caterpillar on the heels of a decision by the Chicago-based Exelon Corporation, one of the nation's largest power providers, to join the FutureGen Alliance that is seeking to build the 275-megawatt plant near Mattoon. Quinn and Durbin, in a joint statement, said Caterpillar's involvement signals critical support and growing corporate momentum for the project, which would use coal while removing the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide and storing it underground, a process known as sequestration. A spokesman for Caterpillar said that the FutureGen project will demonstrate carbon capture and sequestration technologies that are absolutely essential for our planet to realize dramatically needed reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. Bob?
Okay, there was also some good news from Silicon Valley and perhaps the rest of the country. Technology industry bellwether Cisco Systems of San Jose announced last Thursday, that for the quarter ending January 23rd, its profits increased more than 23% to $1.9 billion from the same period a year ago. Cisco says that translates into more jobs, specifically 2,000 to 3,000 openings over the coming months. In contrast, the company last year cut jobs because of the economic recession, which affected its business customers. Cisco Chairman and CEO John Chambers said in a statement, "The figures exceeded our expectations, and we believe they provide a clear indication that we are entering the second phase of the economic recovery." Cisco says all of this means the company will be hiring up to 3,000 workers in its worldwide operations. The news could not have come at a better time for San Jose. Its unemployment rate hovers near 12%, and they're talking about probably 1,000 and overseas and about 2,000 here in the U.S. Dave?
Okay. This is from Counterpunch. It is in an unusually long 1,800-word editorial entitled "The Truth About the Deficit," published February 7th in the New York Times. The editorial in the New York Times cheerleaded for neoliberalism gives its solutions to the country's debt problem. The main idea is summed up thus. quote, to truly tame deficits will require serious health care reform. Obama's plan slashes Medicare. The sooner the better. Other aspects of the long-term fiscal problem, raising taxes and reducing, that is, Social Security, must take place in earnest as the economy recovers. Later, the article is clear and states, quote, and then there is Social Security. What is needed is a combination of benefit cuts and tax increases that preserves the program's essential nature. Of course, those surviving on Social Security already live in poverty and cannot afford benefit cuts. Also, to make a dent in the deficit, benefit cuts to Social Security will have to be quite substantial to the point where the program's essential nature will be destroyed. The New York Times acknowledges that such a course of action will be completely undemocratic and unpopular, but that politicians, quote, must gather the political will to do what must be done. Now, how can politicians destroy these cherished social programs in the face of such popular resistance? By trickery, of course, and this is exactly what Obama has proposed with his bipartisan deficit reduction commission. The deficit commission that Mr. Obama intends to establish would be helpful in breaking the logjam that is resistance to cutting Social Security by calling for necessary changes that politicians would be loath to broach without political cover. Labor unions and community groups also understand Obama's treacherous motives. Dozens of them, including the AFL-CIO and Change to Win, signed a statement condemning the goals behind Obama's deficit commission. The statement includes some politically savvy points, including the following, quote, we urge you to act decisively to prevent the creation of such an extraordinary undemocratic budget commission. The AFL-CIO Change to Win is also calling for members to get involved, but so far there's been no real plan as far as what the members should do. So let's hope that, you know, if nothing else, the rank and file of our unions and other workers out there who are unorganized need to put pressure on our labor leaders to do something. Nothing else, like Bill Gorell, our co-host, suggested, a million worker march on Washington.
The Walmart Corporation is cutting 300 administrative jobs at its headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, as it completes a year-long series of changes to improve its store's performances. In the past 13 months, the company has cut almost 14,000 jobs, and that's not including the Sam's Club job losses. Walmart, which generated some $400 billion in sales last year, has been welcoming wealthier consumers who are trading down from the higher-priced stores during the recession, but it has also noticed the financial strain amongst its core customers, including much less spending between paychecks. Walmart, which has more than 2 million employees worldwide, has changed its global sourcing network and last month cut 11,200 jobs in its 600-store Sam's Club when it turned over in-store demonstrations to an outside company. Those cuts amounted to over 10% of the Sam's Club's workforce. According to Walmart President and CEO Mike Duke, the world's largest retailer trimmed the jobs in order to advance its strategies for improving growth, leverage, and returns. However, Duke had no comment on the fates or futures of the more than 25,000 workers that he and his banker buddies put into the streets.
Okay, I got a short story here, and this relates to what Dave was talking about earlier, and Bill Gorell, and Bill Gorell's Facebook. I wish I remembered his Facebook friends group there, the Hey AFL-CIO, Let's Get a Million Person Unemployed Workers.
Yes, yes.
Anyway, the San Francisco Labor Council is calling on the AFL-CIO and Change to Win to endorse and support an April 10th march in Washington for jobs. That's the 75th anniversary of the Depression-era Works Progress Administration, which created some 8.5 million jobs in the U.S. during the Great Depression of the 1930s. In its resolution supporting the April 10th march, the San Francisco Labor Council says we need the same bold, sweeping jobs program now for the more than 20 million un- and underemployed Americans. So keep your eyes open for that happening.
Wow.
Maybe April 10th.
Okay, I guess great minds think alike, huh?
Yeah.
Either that or they read Bill's Facebook.
Bill and you, and maybe you'll get the AFL-CIO to do something here.
Well, we're going to have Harry Kelber on the show next weekend.
Really?
This ought to be interesting. I think, who knows, sometimes, these sort of things do... gel, if you will. So.
Yeah, this is being promoted by the San Francisco Labor Council.
Good deal. Okay, and finally some good news from Greece. Offices, schools, universities, and public hospitals were brought to a standstill by a general strike on February 10th. The strike called by the main public sector workers' unions confronts the austerity package of the government of the so-called socialist Georgios Papandreou. The belt-tightening plans attempt to, quote-unquote, reorganize the accounts of the state, a requirement that the countries of the European Union are making of Greece to grant the country economic assistance. This is shown by the statements of Michael Meister, representing the German government, that is preparing the aid package. It's quoted as saying, if Greece receives aid, it'll only be under strict conditions, and if the Greek government and state impose substantial, quote-unquote, reforms. What's interesting, too, in a related email I saw this week, part of these so-called reforms, the German government is trying to force the government of Greece to buy German fighter planes. Here they're talking about budget cuts, but yet they want them to buy high-tech fighter planes to upgrade their air force.
Yeah, it cost about $25 million apiece.
Yeah. Anyway, the recipe of the so-called socialist Papandreou does not greatly differ from the old neoliberal recipes to raise the age of retirement, freeze wages, increase taxes on the popular working-class people, while banks and businesses whose bad deals caused the current economic crisis receive $1 billion of bailouts from the state. All the workers get is wage cuts, layoffs, and a tax on their rights. Anyway, the February 10 general strike brought the entire public sector to a standstill. Air traffic controllers who joined the strike forced closing of airports and cancellation of flights. The protests had great support among university teachers and professors, doctors at public hospitals, government office workers, and garbage collectors, who led the first confrontations of the day when they used their garbage trucks to break up the police barricades that were preventing sanitation workers from reaching the central mobilization of the strike in Athens. Public workers are facing a plan that includes 20% wage cuts, while university teachers face 40% cuts. Hiring freezes even in critical fields like healthcare, and increase the retirement age to 65. So we'll have to see how this pans out later on. So,
as you said, that's the first of several organized strikes. I think they've got another one scheduled for
yes, indeed,
February 24th.
That's correct. That's correct. Yes. Thank you for updating me on that. Okay. We're going to have a little musical break here, and then we'll be back with Tom Thomas's poem of the week.
Gotta pull this timber before the sun go down. Get it across the river before the boss come round. Drag it on down that dusty road. Come on, Jerry, let's dump this load.
Hauling
timber, timber. Lord, this timber gotta roll.
Timber,
timber, timber. Lord, this timber gotta roll. My old Jerry is an Arkansas mule. Been everywhere and he ain't no fool. Work gets heavy, old Jerry gets sore. Pull so much and won't pull no more.
Hauling
timber, timber. Lord, this timber gotta roll.
Timber,
timber, timber. Lord, this timber gotta roll. Jerry's old shoulder is 6 foot tall. Pull more timber than a freight can haul. Weigh 922. Done everything a poor mule could do.
Hauling
timber, timber. Lord, this timber gotta roll.
Timber,
timber, timber. Lord, this timber gotta roll. Boss hit Jerry and he made him jump. Jerry ran and kicked the boss on the rump. My old Jerry was a good old mule. Had it been me, Lord, I'd have killed that fool. Boss tried to shoot old Jerry.
Now we're at this point in the Illinois Labor Hour at the Cultural Corner with Tom Thomas's new poem of the week, Our Locomotive Nation.
From the docks sides to the mountains, through the forest and to the plains. Workers built our nation for us and did so through some grievous pains. Our forefathers were all workers when they signed that declaration, and in spite of some blemishes, they built a pretty good nation. A nation like a locomotive, still strongly rolling on its track. A society moving forward and never ever looking back. Even through this winter bitter, that locomotive's chugging on, climbing all the grades before it, and will until its steam is gone. Yet looking past analogy, it is a frightening sight we see, our locomotive's losing steam, depressing our society. Our steam can't come when jobs are lost and the locomotive's slowing. We need to get our jobs back now to once again get us growing. A million marching on D.C. is something that we really need. Maybe our reps would open their eyes and bring an end to fascist greed. Stop the billions in bonuses the bankers are stealing away, and that can be the beginning of a brighter, sunnier day. Our Locomotive Nation was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on February 12, 2010, and was first recited live February 13, 2010, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. And I have a few public service announcements here. Statewide conference on occupation, safety, and health, fighting for health and safety in the Great Recession at the I Hotel and Conference Center, 1900 South 1st Street, Champaign, Illinois, May 20th to 22nd. This is presented by the University of Illinois Labor Education Program and co-sponsored by the Illinois Occupation Environmental Health and Safety Education Research Center at the University of Illinois Chicago and the Chicago Area Committee on Occupational Safety and Health. For more information, you can contact Joe Berry at 217-333-0980. Also, tomorrow from 4 to 5 p.m. And every Sunday is Labor's View TV. This week's topic will be the 1934 Minneapolis General Strike. We got some great old film footage, and we have a special guest, a member of the Laborers Union, who also was a Teamster, who attended the 60th anniversary up there about 15 years ago and was talked to many of the participants. Fortunately, there's very few of them left now 15 years later, but he's our guest on the show. So tune in to Labor's View tomorrow on Comcast Channel 6 or Band of Public Television at 4 p.m. And next Saturday at 12:30 p.m. At the Independent Media Center, 202 South Broadway, the downtown Urbana Post Office, will be the monthly meeting of the Central Illinois Industrial Workers of the World. All workers are welcome, and it starts at 12:30. Okay, since this is February, this is African History Month, I would like to, for the rest of the Saturdays this month, do a little profile on various African-American labor activists that have been involved throughout the ages. Now, you know, we don't need February to honor African-American activists or activists of any ethnic organization group. Last month on Martin Luther King's birthday, we did a good profile on him, especially his last few days when he was in Memphis to help support the sanitation workers' strike. And also that Martin Luther King's whole focus the last year of his life was directed on a poor people's campaign. So anyway, today we're going to highlight a person by the name of Hubert Harrison. And Hubert Henry Harrison was born April 27, 1883, and he died December 17, 1927. He was a West Indian American writer, orator, educator, critic, and radical political activist based in Harlem, New York City. He was described by A. Philip Randolph, the president of the Pullman Car Porters Union, as, quote, the father of Harlem radicalism, and by the historian Joel Augustus Rogers as the foremost African-American intellect of his time. Harrison profoundly influenced generations of new Negro militants. Besides A. Philip Randolph, also influenced Chandler Owen, Marcus Garvey, Richard Benjamin Moore, and Cyril Briggs. Harrison became interested in the free thought movement, which encouraged use of scientific methods and thoughts thought free of religious dogma. He broke from Christianity and became an agnostic, similar to Thomas Huxley. His new worldview placed humanity and God at its center, and in 1907, Harrison obtained work as a clerk with the United States Post Office when he was still a really young man. Harrison was an early supporter of the protest philosophies of W.E.B. Du Bois and William Monroe Trotter, particularly after the Brownsville affair. He became an outspoken critic of Presidents Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft and of the Republican Party. He also criticized the prominent black leader, Booker T. Washington, whose political philosophy Harrison considered subservient. In 1910, Harrison wrote two letters to the New York Times that were critical of statements by Washington. And as a result, Harrison lost his postal employment through what he said were efforts of Washington's powerful Tuskegee machine. 1911, after his postal firing, Harrison began full-time work with the Socialist Party of America and became America's leading black socialist. He lectured widely against capitalism, campaigned for the party presidential candidate Eugene V. Debs in 1912, and founded the Colored Socialist Club. He developed two important and pioneering theoretical series on the Negro and socialism for the socialist newspaper, The New York Call. He maintained that it was the principal duty of the socialists to champion the cause of African American other oppressed minorities. Harrison moved to the left in the Socialist Party. He supported the socialistic, egalitarian, militantly radical industrial workers of the world and became a member of the IWW. He's a prominent speaker with IWW leaders Bill Hayward, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Carlo Trecca, and Patrick Quinlan at the historic 1913 Paterson, New Jersey silk strike of 1913. He had quite extensive writings, which have just recently been rediscovered. In fact, currently in New York City at Columbia University, there's the whole collection of his writings that the university had acquired from a private collection. Briefly to sum up, in 1917, African Americans and others were asked to make the world safe for democracy by fighting during World War I. In the United States, lynchings, racial segregation, discrimination, and white supremacist ideology continued. Harrison found the Liberty League and the Voice as radical alternatives to the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Harrison also became involved for a while with Marcus Garvey's organization, but Harrison began, after being with that organization for a while, to criticize Garvey for exaggerations, financial schemes, and desire for empire. In contrast to Garvey, Harrison emphasized that African Americans' principal struggle was in the United States, not Africa. Through Harrison, continued to write for the Negro World in 1922. He looked to develop political alternatives to Garvey. Harrison's appeal was both mass and individual. His race-conscious mass appeal utilized newspapers, popular lectures, and street corner talks. Biographer Jeffrey Perry writes that among the African-American leaders of his era, Harrison was, quote, the most class-conscious of the race radicals and the most race-conscious of the class radicals. Perry emphasized that Harrison was a key unifying figure between two major trends of African-American struggle, the labor civil rights trend identified with A. Philip Randolph and later with Martin Luther King, and the race nationalist trend identified with Garvey and later with Malcolm X. And he has been described as, quote, the most distinguished, if not most well-known, Caribbean American radical in the United States in the early 20th century by historian Winston James. But it's amazing how few people know about him. I wasn't even aware of Hubert Harris until just a short time ago.
This is the first I've heard of him.
Yes, and it sounds like he's quite a profound person. I mean, it's all he did and everything. But that's nothing new. It's like Howard Zinn has pointed out, the recently deceased Howard Zinn, in his People's History of the United States. It's no mistake that our history, a history of working class people, has been buried intentionally. So we now move to the latter half of the Illinois World Labor Hour, and we have a very special live guest in the studio. His name's Jim Duffett, and he's with the Campaign for Better Healthcare. Jim, welcome to the Labor Hour.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
Okay, well, tell us just a little bit about yourself, and then tell us what you've been doing lately.
Well, for the last 30 years of my life, I've been fighting for a variety of causes of social justice, but the primary one is affordable, accessible, guaranteed quality health care for everybody. And I've been working as the executive director of the Campaign for Better Healthcare, which is an organization that has offices here in Champaign and Chicago, and is the state's largest grassroots coalition of about 325 different organizations.
Okay, well, that's great. And there's another organization, of course, here in town, the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers, which you happen to share the same building, the Lincoln Building, downtown Main Street here in Champaign. Can you kind of explain a little bit about two organizations collaborate what's your difference in focus or activity?
They do an excellent lot of great local organizing activity. We mostly focus at the state level. and mm-hmm. also at the national level on issues, and also a lot of regional issues that we work on in the Chicagoland area with a wide range of community-based organizations.
Okay. Well, now, I met you at the Labor Day Parade here this last September, and since then I've talked to a few people I have a lot of admiration for that really have complimented you on you as a person as well as your commitment to this cause, and gosh, you really got your work cut out for you here, don't you? I mean, with trying to get a healthcare system in this country like every other industrialized country in the world has, including even some lesser developed countries, and facing massive roadblocks along the way. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? Or?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we all know we're constantly faced, and I would say even more so faced right now, that the heart and soul of America is in peril, and the party of no and the corporate interests are going to do everything they can and have done everything they can to stop healthcare reform, to stop a jobs proposal, to stop environmental proposal, to stop immigration. If we fail, then we all will fail on those issues. And frankly, I don't say this as a partisan at all, because at least I have to give the Republicans credit that they are extremely principled and they're much more mean-spirited than at least the Democratic Party is. And I know we are very much concerned about the reality of what might happen in November. We personally support a single payer system. Mm-hmm. It works,
which is basically expanding
Medicare for all.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And those single payers are primarily a financial a funding mechanism system. There's a lot of other reforms that would need to happen. And deeply disturbed that option did not get a fair hearing in Washington. But we also have to understand, who controls Washington, and where we are today, and what needs to move forward and needs to be passed. I will say that when we were in D.C. a couple weeks ago at a national conference and then lobbying our state, our Congress people about where the status of reform is at, and mm-hmm. that they need to move forward. There were some interesting observations. I mean, I'm surely not going to cheer that the proposal that's on the table in Washington is the most progressive and plan out there. Mm-hmm. But I'm also not going to rip it apart. And I kind of want to give a couple different examples here. Last February, a year ago, many of us cheered when the S-CHIP expansion program, and that's a plan for health care for working parents, passed.
And that's is Illinois Kid Care part of S-CHIP?
Yeah, Illinois
program?
And All Kids program, mm-hmm. and are all part of that.
And I have to just state here, sure. that my daughter's on Illinois Kid Care, and I have to say that it's one of the things Blagojevich did do right, because my wife and I have lost good-paying jobs. We now have been forced to take very low-paying jobs, and if that wasn't for kids and all kids family care, for $15 a month,
right.
For great coverage, low-priced prescription drugs. I don't, because my daughter has slight bout with asthma off and on, and those inhalers, if you don't have a prescription, are like over $100 a piece. I don't know what we do, so I'm just,
right. No,
maybe
absolutely.
Cheering on S-CHIP here, because it was really
right.
good.
Well, and I think, I'll continue, but I'll step back. I think mm-hmm. one of the faults that I know our organization does not do well enough is to really reinforce the positive programs that this country has passed, like Medicare,
mm-hmm.
and we know and we see statements of the right wing and the fascist teabaggers out there saying get government out of Medicare,
mm-hmm.
and I think programs like All Kids and others that we need to do a much stronger job in reinforcing that in the mindset of the American people of the effectiveness of this program. But we all cheered pretty darn high and worked hard to pass that bill that definitely added 4 more million Americans to that program, and under the plans that are before Congress right now, If a bill had passed today that added 15 more million people to the Medicaid rolls, I think we'd be pretty damn happy, and we would be cheering that. That's a component that is in this proposal. Another proposal component in there is adding 15 to 17 million Americans to be able to get subsidized health care through an exchange. So a lot of questions about the exchange. You know, we're pushing for more of a national exchange, that there are national standards that are there versus a state-by-state exchange. May not look good, may have to be state-by-state, and it's a battle that that we're going to have to fight once again against the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry and all the other corporate interests that basically control health insurance. But, you know, that is going to open up Pandora's box. It is going to add more people into the boat. It is going to add more political leverage to future fights that we have to do. I mean, you know, a lot of my background comes from the labor movement and my dad's involvement in the union, and, you know, I think he probably would go on strike 9 out of 10 negotiations, but he, you know, pushed the political envelope, understood that, you know, when you go on strike, you got to go on strike and you got to be sure you win, or you'll devastate, you know, your union and the efforts that, that you're doing. And the other thing that this plan, in terms of those people, which is a family of four making $88,000, would be eligible for subsidies to pay for health insurance, it'd be another 80 million Americans out there who currently live below 400% of poverty and would not be eligible for Medicaid, who also will be able to get subsidies. The other thing is, it would be great if there was even a piece of legislation. I mean, could you imagine if even today we found out that there was going to be legislation that would, A, you know, end the immoral and ethical practices of the insurance industry that not only denies people access to health care but for pre-existing condition, but if you have health insurance, they have the right to just yank that right from you.
Oh, yes.
And force people into bankruptcy. And, you know, just in this past week, there were reports that showed that the five largest, you know, insurance companies in this country in 2009, the greatest recession, and I would argue it's a depression that many people in many communities are facing, these suckers ended up making $13 billion profit, but yet there were nearly 3 million more Americans who did not have health insurance. I don't know what percentage of those 3 million people are with Aetna, United Healthcare, WellPoint, those others, but these guys are continually profiting. They're continually cutting off health care to people to be able to, you know, continue to pay the outrageous salaries of workers. Let me say, and the other key component in this, and while this is too of a low of a percentage, but it would force the insurance industry that every dollar that they spend, 85 cents of that would have to go to provide health insurance. And, you know, it's shocking, but I think, again, it goes back to the earlier comment I say, that we need to do a better job in letting people know the facts and the efficiency of programs like Medicare. Every dollar that we spend on Medicare, less than 3 cents, goes to the bloated, and I say that word in a very sarcastic way, the bloated bureaucracy of the federal government. You know, my HMO that I have here in town, you know, they're proud to tell me that 17 cents of every dollar, you know, goes to administrative costs. And that's, you know, there are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of wasted billion dollars. 85% is too low, but at least it begins to get something there and begins to, you know, to move forward.
Well, you know, this is pretty promising. These are a lot of details that I wasn't aware of. I mean, it sounds like, you know, your battles and everything, granted, you have tremendous obstacles still in your path, but you have made a little progress here. But, you know, two things. One, I was just in a conversation with a fellow carpenter friend of mine who just retired this year, you know, we were talking about health care and stuff, and he's mentioned, I mentioned about, you know, well, we need to expand Medicare for all, because he's forced to pay out $700 a month for him and his wife, and that's about a third of his pension check that he's getting. And you know, and I mentioned the fact that, well, you know, this is insane. It has to stop. I mean, we got to go with what every other industrialized country in the world has, is, you know, Medicare for all. And he goes, but that'll raise our taxes. You know, of course, you know, that's a common propaganda statement that the insurance industry is putting out there, that it'll raise our taxes. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it's an ongoing, the lies and fears of the death panels.
The death
I mean,
panels,
we have
yes.
death panels already, and it's
Indeed.
Called the insurance industry. And at least from our perspective, I mean, the insurance industry is basically a leech on the healthcare system. There's no role of a sane role that they play. But you know, an average family in the state of Illinois, you know, pays an extra $1,500 a year on higher healthcare premiums because of the growing number of uninsured. There are some hospitals that surely don't do enough of free care and uncompensated care. There are a lot of hospitals that do a lot, and they're forced to be able, you know, to try to continue that and to provide health care. They have to raise the cost to all of us who are fortunate to have health insurance.
So you're saying we're paying for it already, actually?
Oh, we're paying for it already. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're paying it. I mean, you look, if we had a system of universal health care, I mean, I would not have to pay health insurance on my automobile insurance because everyone would be covered. But I pay a good chunk. I think it's, I'm trying to remember what the last time I saw was maybe $450 a year. Mm-hmm. That's just related to health insurance because of I hit somebody or somebody hits me to be covered. Homeowners insurance is the same way. Property tax, you know, our property taxes continue to go up. And one of the reasons is because, you know, and I'm all in favor of continuing to have health insurance to provide to our public workers or teachers and everything. But as those costs go up, we're the ones that have to do it. Though at the same time, cost shifting and those intense negotiations that workers are going through, you know, continues to happen. But you know, we're paying for it already. And you know, where the situation is basically, you're going to be hearing, the Republicans and their media people have definitely had the upper hand on this issue for the last 4 or 5 months.
But it's not just the Republicans, though. We see a lot of Democrats out there.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And I want to talk about a few things that we're doing here statewide and also locally because the deep frustration that we have in even dealing with the people who call themselves Democrats is a good chunk of them are spineless. Mm-hmm. And we have to make sure, and they're different congresspeople. In the state of Illinois, we have 19 congresspeople. 12 are registered Democrats and 7 are Republicans. All 7 Republicans voted no. Mm-hmm. Locally, our Congressman Johnson here. All 12 Democrats voted yes for the House proposal that passed. But there are some that we're talking to, and as I'll get into what we're doing, are very nervous about doing activities.
And why are they nervous exactly?
Well, they hope that whatever November 2nd or November 9th, whatever the November election day is, they hope it happens as soon as possible versus stepping up and rolling up their sleeves and really articulating the impact that this health care plan will do.
Well, who are they afraid of, though, exactly, because of a vast majority of Americans support expanding Medicare?
Absolutely. Well, I think they are definitely scared that, you know, the lies still have taken hold, that this bill passes. There's still 27% of Americans who still believe that death panels are there. There's still that equal amount of people that believe that if you have more than 2 children, that third child could very well be taken away from you and put up for adoption because you will have violated or that health care will not be covering that third child.
Oh, that's a new one. I haven't heard that.
Oh,
one.
Yeah. Your guns are going to be taken away.
Oh.
I mean, the list goes on and on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if these folks, you know, and like I said earlier, I mean, the heart and soul of our country, you know, is at stake. And I truly feel that, you know, the leverage that the right wing had even in 1994 was pretty daunting and pretty scary. I feel that, you know, it is even stronger today. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all know that you know, fascism in this country and people who believe in fascism in this country are much stronger than the name calling that they're trying to call President Obama socialist and all these policies, you know, as socialist. Mm-hmm. That you know, the fear from fascism in this country is definitely much greater than any fear of this country moving into a more equitable and equal society that some would equate with socialism, that others of us would equate it with just more, you know, fairness and equality of society.
Okay, and getting back to their fear, certain members of Congress, how much of that fear do you think, instead of that 27% of the population that might be able to swing an election in a close contest, our fear of losing corporate money from the insurance industry?
Well, you know, definitely is an issue. I mean, I think for a lot of Democrats, though, they don't get that much insurance money, but there's enough of money out there. I mean, there's enough of key Democrats like
Max Baucus
and all those. But, you know, if I'm looking at the 12 Democrats here in Illinois, mm-hmm. and as one has looked at their financial statements, there is some money. Probably not enough, but I think the fear that many people do have, of course, is the recent Supreme Court ruling that, mm-hmm. that opens up the floodgates even more. But if these folks, and I think, you know, you look polls, was interesting about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, CBS did a fascinating poll that, and many of us were been saying this for months and months and months and months, but it's the first time that they actually did this poll. They looked at the 52% of people who opposed health reform. Mm-hmm. And you alluded to this earlier, but there's another stat that I want to mention. When you talk about the proposal going through Congress, 52% end up opposing it. But then when you break it down into different pieces, you still are in the mid-60s to the high 70s of people who support some of those key components that I alluded to earlier in breaking it down. But then they ask those 52% of people is, why are you opposed to it?
Mm-hmm.
And nearly a third of those folks were opposed to it because it didn't go far enough.
Absolutely.
Which is definitely a very deep frustration that we have. Again, I think we would feel, you know, it's like anybody that goes into negotiations, you know, did we think that we were going to pass single payer this year at all? Not at all. Did we think we were going to get a roll call on it, at least in the House? Absolutely. Very frustrating that that did not happen. But at least a fallback position, and we surely were not ones who felt that a public option was a cop-out. We felt that that was also a very good position, and frankly, we've always advocated it, and actually it went through a process here in the state of Illinois that President Obama at that time was a state senator, that a process that we called the Health Care Justice Act that we did back in the late 2005, 2006, and 2007, that there was a public option that was in there. And we feel that, you know, it is a backdoor way to finally to get to single payer, and it was a way for people to really understand, you know what? Let's look at what, you know, why is a public option much cheaper? Well, you know, the head of Medicare gets paid probably $225,000 a year versus, you know, the head of United Healthcare, who I think he's somewhere at $100 to $150 million, mm-hmm. plus they have stockholders, plus they have these folks who are called actuaries who don't want to cover your child who has asthma because that's a cost that they're going to do. You know, all those costs would be off the table. And if you're truly a fiscal conservative and you truly care about the utilization of your dollars, you know, why are you spending 19 cents more of every dollar to go to the insurance industry for private sector bureaucracy? But, you know, taking that 25%, you know, as I say to them all the time, you know, folks, you know, this is a much bigger issue than just healthcare right now. Mm-hmm. And in all seriousness, a real nervousness that if we don't force the Democrats to have some spine, and I'm not only talking about the spine at the federal level, and I'm going to stress on that and talk about some of the things that we're going to be doing, but I also want to talk about some secondary goals that have a direct impact to not only our local representatives and state senators here, but also state representatives and senators throughout the state of Illinois,
okay.
in terms of what things that can be faced.
Before you go into that, right. can I ask how Dick Durbin stands on this?
Dick Durbin has been a strong advocate on mm-hmm. On the public option,
okay.
and has played a very key role in pushing the political envelope internally. We've been definitely in, if not daily, most definitely weekly conversation with his staff, and has continued to be a voice out there. He definitely said, I can count to 60, and 60, and the votes aren't there. I mean, it also shows, you know, kind of the millionaires club that exists in Washington. When I use 60, it's the whole issue of a filibuster.
Right.
That democracy does not play in this country. I mean, we know democracy, to a large extent, does not play in this country, but we have to deal with at least what we have and mm-hmm. how we exploit that and how we move folks and take power and take control. People like you mentioned, Mr. Lieberman, Ben Nelson, many other people mm-hmm. were the ones that can derail this.
And what about the new Democratic elect in the primaries for the U.S. Senate seat that's currently held by Roland Burris? Do you know much about him?
Alexia, has. Headlease is embracing, you know, what's going on, you know, at the federal level. Mm-hmm. We've not really had a detailed discussion with him in terms of, you know, how far. I mean, I would say, you know, many Democrats, and I'm not saying this directed to him at all, mm-hmm. you know, are trying to figure out how they maneuver through this. Mm-hmm. And when I say that, that has definitely a double-edged sword.
Yes.
You can be a wimp. And maneuver it, and we all lose ground. Or you can maneuver it and have some spine and step up and say enough's enough.
Yeah.
And I'm going to roll up my sleeves and I'm going to go out there and I'm going to, you know, not allow the Tim Johnsons of the world and other people to get away with the lies that, you know, his last publication that I got in the mail and probably all of us got in the mail, you know, told about you know, these drastic cuts to Medicare. Well, let's talk about one of the drastic cuts to Medicare. Nearly $175 million will be cut out of Medicare. And what that cut is it's being cut against the welfare payments that the Bush administration and the Republican Party and some Democrats granted back when in December of 2003 when they passed Medicare Part D, that it was a slow process of privatizing Medicare. They've always been for privatizing Medicare, we mm-hmm. know. They've always been in favor of privatizing Social Security. So what happens is that now the insurance industry, like Health Alliance, Medicare Advantage they have now, if you're a physician and you're a Medicare physician, and I come in to see you, and let's say the procedure costs $100, you're only going to get reimbursed $100. But if you're affiliated with a for-profit or not-for-profit, which frankly anymore there's you can't tell the difference of
sure.
them at all, is that you'll get paid $119.
Huh.
And so there is payment slowly, and part of what they were asking these HMOs in Medicare to do is to provide more services. And what those services they provide are you can get, you know, discount rentals at Blockbuster. You're allowed to get either a, you know, come in on a monthly basis, and there's a seminar talking about staying active as a senior, you know, discounts at different physical gyms around the community, you know, discounts at the coffee shop at Carl. And there was a study that came out and showed that 19% that the insurance industry is getting in welfare payments from we as taxpayers is nearly 88% of that is additional pure profit. So they're only using 12% of it for these add-ons, which, you know, are good add-ons. However, you know, the real Medicare program needs to be, and so that's where the guts of it is. But of course, you know, Tim is so much in bed with Health Alliance here in Illinois that he's scaring people to make people think that this is exactly what's going to, you're going to lose benefits. And, you know, the benefits that you may lose as a senior may be that 10% discount at the coffee shop at Carl or someplace else. You're not going to lose one benefit in the Medicare program at all. And in fact, it's even going to even be better because the cost, the other benefits that are going to be cut is right now, good or bad, you would think, huh, why would you need an incentive? Hospitals, why would you need an incentive? Well, right now, if I'm a senior and I go in for a procedure and, you know, for a variety of reasons, those institutions will only do so much, you know, mm-hmm. and I get sent back home. And if I have to go back in for the same procedure, I'm only going to get the same amount of money that I was reimbursed the first time. So there hasn't been incentives in there to be able to you know, really solve that problem for that person. I scratched my head and said, I would think that if you're a medical institution, the incentive because of who you are is to solve that person's problem. Well, of course, we know that's a naive statement, that there's money and profit all involved into it. Now there's going to be an incentive for those institutions to say, if that person does not come back in to your hospital, you'll get a little higher reimbursement to be able to solve that. Those are the cuts that are not only going against the insurance industry, but to, you know, force greater efficiencies within the private sector.
Well, Jim, this has been very informative. We just have a few minutes left here, and I definitely want you to tell us about what you've got planned coming up, because this is pretty exciting stuff.
We just launched this week throughout the state of Illinois, and you can go to our website, and I urge people to get on our listserv, is we're asking people to drop off a pair of empty shoes in front of all your congressperson's office. We're going to be releasing a report on Tuesday, and we'll be having a die-in both both in Chicago and in Springfield with our faith leaders to talk about how many people have died. And so many of these people talk about being pro-life and who are opposed to health insurance reform. How many people died from 95 through 2009? And how many people in the state of Illinois are projected to die from 2010 to 2019 if health care reform is not happening? And at the same time, so we're going to ask people, stop by his office, whether he's there or not, drop off a pair of shoes, put a little note in it. We have a lot of different messages that we have. If you're able to listserv it out to your members to do that. And actually, starting this week, all through the next 5 weeks at least, we're going to be doing two events a week. We're going to be doing a positive event with those members of Congress to try to get them some additional spine, and then we're going to be doing civil disobedience events with these members who are opposed to health care reform, and we're going to intensify this fight here in Illinois, and I know with many of our sister and brother organizations in other states that are also going to be doing civil disobedience. We cannot lose this fight. We have to win this fight. You know, even Social Security, when Social Security passed in 1935, you know, it did not have benefits for domestic workers. It did not have benefits for agricultural workers. And we all know Frances Perkins was one heck of a secretary of labor. And she even made a comment that she was wondering if it was going to be good enough, if we should even pass it. Well, I think she realized that it is good enough. It's a safety net for all of us to end up retiring. And I urge people, you know, we have to send a very clear message here in Champaign-Urbana to Tim Johnson, which also sends a message to our state rep and state senator as they're debating in Springfield right now about tax increases, cutting back on Medicaid, cutting back on HIV services, cutting back on other things. You know, if we don't force this issue and we don't put that political pressure on both these Republicans and Democrats, you know, how frustrating some of these components of these bills are, we all lose out, and I just urge people to take action.
Wow, this has been great. Bob, do you want to?
Well, Jim, what is your website?
It's www.cbhc.org.
All right. Thanks.
Yes, indeed. This has been a great interview. Thank you so much for coming in, Jim. I mean, there's been a lot of informative information here and also some course of action, which we really like to promote here in the Labor Hour. Please keep us updated. Feel free to email me any events, and we'll make sure we get them on in the public service announcements.
Thank you very much.
Again, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks, Jim.
Planes flying across the land and sea. Everybody flying them but a Negro like me. Uncle Sam says, your place is on the ground. When I fly my airplanes, don't want no Negro round. The same thing for the Navy when ships go to sea. All they got is a mess boy's job for me, Uncle Sam says. Keep on your apron, son. You know I ain't gonna let you shoot my big Navy gun. Got my long government letters, my time to go. When I got to the army, found the same old Jim Crow. Uncle Sam says, two camps for black and white. But when trouble starts,